Our last speaker of the day has worked closely with trade unions for many years. He is the director of the International Program on Labor, Climate and Environment at the Murphy Institute of Worker Education and Labor Studies at the City University of New York. He is also one of those who initiated Trade Unions for Energy Democracy. Trade Unions for Energy Democracy is a global multi-sector initiative to advance democratic direction and control of energy in a way that promotes solutions to the climate crisis, to energy poverty, the degradation of both land and people, and who responds to the attacks on workers' rights and protection. Please welcome Sean Sweeney.
I've asked Cheska 6 times how to pronounce her name, so I hope I didn't make a mess of it. It's a great honor to be here. I'm a little embarrassed that I'm the last speaker, but it's a great honor to have this opportunity to talk about the role of trade unions in the climate movement. What I want to try to do in the 20 minutes I have is to talk a little bit about why trade unions for energy democracy and energy democracy is such an important question. But secondly, to also tell you a little bit about what's happening, because there have been some very good and encouraging developments around the world in the last year or two that we should all be encouraged about. But the main goal of the project in the short term is to encourage unions to undertake a programmatic shift. The program the unions have had in the last decade or two is not adequate. It's not adequate to deal with the climate crisis, and it's not adequate to deal with the social crisis. So this is a discussion that's going on inside the trade union movement itself. Now, unions are, of course, institutionally have been in trouble now for 30 years. They've been in retreat, but they're still big organizations in Europe and the rest of the world. They have resources, they have ideas, they have traditions. But what we're seeing, I think, with the climate crisis and the present crisis of the capitalist system itself is a redefining of trade unionism, a rethink about the need to understand that the exploitation of people is directly related to the exploitation of nature. We are inseparable from nature, and we live in a system that is totally extractive and exploitative in that respect. So it's no good just talking about growth anymore and trying to share the wealth. We need to be talking about the dynamics of the system and how to have a truly sustainable society. The whole idea of, if I may turn to the whole Paris Agreement discussion, I'm not going to say too much about this because it's been dealt with during the course of this great meeting. And Mark Campanelli's presentation raised an issue for me. The 2-degree scenario is fine if they intend to stick to it. So a lot of the economic arguments about fossil fuels make sense if you think that 2 degrees is a real commitment. So yes, the fossil fuel companies will be in trouble. But what other people have said is there is a contradiction in the agreement. It acknowledges the science, the need for 1.5 degrees or well below 2 degrees. But the reality, the political reality, is we're destined for 3.4 degrees under the agreement. And that assumes that all of the national commitments will be met by 2030. This is a civilizational crisis. The agreement acknowledges the science, but locks in commitments not to reduce emissions, but to actually increase emissions. A lot of the rhetoric around the agreement is, oh, we've decided to reduce emissions, but it's not. If you look at the agreement, emissions will increase, but less slowly than business as usual. I've been going to the UN climate meetings for almost 10 years. It was in 2007 I heard the leader of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change say that this was a defining moment, that we couldn't wait any longer to reduce emissions, And by 2015, emissions should be going down dramatically. Well, it's 2016, and we've just agreed to increase emissions from now until 2030. This makes the case for a change, because I say there that market approaches have failed. So why is that a market problem? It's a market problem for the following reason. It's not, as a lot of groups say, a problem of political will. This has been the narrative of the environmental movement and, to some extent, the trade union movement and other social movements. They say, it's time for you to show political will. But this isn't the problem. The problem is that the dynamics of growth, accumulation, expansion, which is the dynamics of capitalism, is in complete contradiction to the science of climate. If this was about trade agreements, there's no shortage of political will. We've got legally binding trade agreements being negotiated now that will devastate our chances of even reaching 2 degrees, let alone reaching even these commitments. So the problem is also one of markets. So anybody over 50 may recognize this scene from the Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail. The global carbon market is the holy grail of neoliberal climate policy at the moment. What does it mean? Essentially, we've heard, even in this meeting, and we've heard throughout the last 10 or 15 years talking about climate change, that the problem is the polluter doesn't pay for the right to pollute the atmosphere. So we need to put a price on carbon, and the best way of doing that is not with heavy-handed government interventions, but by having willing partners trading permits between themselves and reducing the permits over time. This is the logic of the Stern Review of 2006. This is the logic of unleashing the private sector to solve the problem of climate. Where are we 10 years later? First of all, I have the pleasure of reviewing the World Bank's 2015 State and Trends of Carbon Markets for some trade unions. And what do we find? A glowing report that says that carbon markets have tripled in their geographical reach in the last 10 years. So look at the data and you think, oh, this is all going according to plan, until you realize that it's 12% of world greenhouse gas emissions are covered by a price, which is another way of saying that 88% is not covered by a price. The other problem for this is that the price is around about $10 a ton in 90% of cases or more. And $10 a ton, we don't want to get too technical, but it's basically small change to the corporations. $80 to $120 a ton is what the World Bank says the carbon price should be, and it should be global. So we're not there, we're not going to get there, and the market is failing. I won't have time to go into the investment figures. Here's the renewable investment figures for the European Union. You heard a bit from Mark about the investments in fossil fuels. $900 billion in 2014, $200 billion for renewable energy. This is not a world on track for 2 degrees. This is a world on track for a much higher level of warming. Now, the trade unions, let's turn to them. For many years, unions would go to the climate meetings and understood that the agreements were largely beyond their control. Market mechanisms were established as the way to go, unleash the power of the private sector. And these ideas have influenced the trade unions. That report there, Inclusive Green Growth, is from the World Bank. It talks about private markets, and it's been picked up by the trade unions. You hear a lot of union leaders talk about inclusive green growth. Secondly, the International Labour Organization echoes this. The most radical thing in that document is that to gradually reduce the subsidies for fossil fuel companies. None of these documents go into the question of ownership and control of energy, resources, infrastructure, and options. Without that control, there will be no possibilities of reducing emissions according to what science demands. Now, politically, in the EU, unions have tried to play a constructive role. They make many good suggestions, and they're all ignored. So the idea of social partnership and social dialogue is largely bankrupt at the moment. And most trade union leaders would acknowledge that they're not getting much from this policy. So unions, some of them, are seeking a different path. This is no insult to kittens, but it's fair to say, I believe, that the trade union movement has boxed itself into a position of weakness. It's got a gun to its head, and it's largely incapable of threatening its opponents. So that's something we have to fundamentally deal with as a movement if we're going to play a role, not just in the climate crisis, but to protect workers and their families, not just in Europe, but all over the world. Now, we see the debate is beginning to happen. You can see Andreas put this fantastic document together on 100,000 climate jobs in Norway. The 1 million climate jobs campaign in the UK is supported by unions. There are climate job campaigns in South Africa, Canada, and elsewhere. The idea is an aggressive, science-based approach to emissions will create work. The work has to be created in the public domain as a public good for the benefit of everybody. That's climate jobs. That's the essential notion of climate jobs. Now, to the project that I'm coordinating right now with the help of unions, including some in this room, is Trade Unions for Energy Democracy. If we can't control the energy system, we won't be able to stabilize the climate, is the essential point of departure for the project. The immediate goals of the project is to build a community of unions. Bear in mind that for 30 years, unions who supported public ownership have been on the defensive. They've seen privatizations, they've seen defeats, and they've lost confidence in the idea that taking something back into public ownership, democratizing it and restructuring it for the public good is politically possible. In many parts of the world, that's seen as a bridge too far. But increasingly, unions are beginning to be more confident on the need for that solution, not just to the climate. There are many climate problems. There are many other issues that would support the case for energy democracy. Exploitative relationships in the workplace, high prices, energy poverty, low levels of investment in the sector. So we could make a strong case for taking energy back into the public sphere, even if there wasn't a climate crisis. But the climate crisis means that the only way we can transition to radically scaled up renewable power to fulfill what is technically possible by moving decisively towards wind and solar in a way that allows for a just transition for the workforce in the fossil fuel sectors, not what we're seeing going on now, then only public ownership and social control is the only option, really, to deal with that. The market has failed to drive renewables to a sufficient level. Now, these are some of the unions involved. There are 47 unions from 17 countries who have participated. I got a call a few weeks ago from Nepal. They want to participate in the project. The Northern Territories of Australia, the unions there want to participate. They're all beginning to reach the same conclusions, that there needs to be a global struggle for the control of the energy system in order to democratize it and restructure it. Now, a few more minutes, if I may. Resistance to the fossil fuel expansion is growing all over the world. This is a scene outside the White House, the Keystone XL pipeline. I'll turn to that struggle in a moment. But we see it even in countries that we're not expecting. India, there's major struggles against new coal-fired power stations. We see that in China, this is not about climate change. The struggles there, the occupation of a coal-fired power station, was about the air quality. 4,000 people every day, according to the World Health Organization, die of fossil-related pollution. The air quality, as many of you know, in China, in India, and other countries in the global south, is deteriorating rapidly. The World Health Organization data said in 2012, 7.2 million people died as a result of exposure to fossil fuel pollution. So this is happening now. They call it the airpocalypse for a reason. So the struggle there is not necessarily about climate change. It's about the right to live, the right to go outside and breathe air, the right to have a decent life. This is a huge problem. But it means also that there's a climate movement growing in China as we speak. And it will explode in China because the unsustainable nature of the expansion and the use of coal in China and other countries will lead to large movements in the future. This police van was turned over by workers and community members who took over the coal-fired power station to shut it down. Now, the Keystone Pipeline, in the few minutes I have left, the significance of this, it was really quite something. I was involved with it very personally. We found out that TransCanada Corporation was going to build a 1,700-mile pipeline from one of the largest industrial projects on Earth, which is the tar sands. Yes, the tar sands is in trouble now because of oil prices. A lot of workers have been laid off. But there's more oil up there than there is in Saudi Arabia. Now, it's not oil. It's bitumen. If we waited another 500 million years, it would be oil. But oil companies don't want to wait 500 million years. If the price is right, they'll sell it on the global markets. It's not right at the moment, but 5 years from now it could be. So this was a struggle to build a pipeline to get that oil into the global market to where the demand was highest, particularly the Pacific Rim countries. They tried to build the pipeline west to Vancouver area, and it was stopped by indigenous groups and also by fisher communities. So they tried Plan B, and they thought they'd go through the middle of Republican-controlled America. And they got some unions to say, we will build the pipeline, and we want to build this pipeline because it creates jobs. This led to a major struggle, not just in American society, but in the trade union movement as well. Now, six unions ended up opposing the project. This was an important cultural shift for the trade unions in the United States. It's very, very rare a union will say, we're opposing that project that's going to give your members jobs, even though we have no real direct say in the project. But nurses' unions and public transport unions were the first ones, and they said, look, and this is why it's redefining the labor movement, we have a responsibility to advocate for our patients. We have a responsibility to advocate for our passengers in the case of transport workers. If we allow a pipeline to go through the United States and export tar oil to the rest of the world, which will be burned, and then the atmosphere, the pollutants will fly back, whether it's in the form of global warming or some other form of pollutants, it will poison Chinese and other workers and communities. We have a moral and political responsibility to stand with the people opposing that pipeline. Farmers, ranchers, indigenous people, students and youth, climate activists. And those unions were brave enough to say, enough, we are opposing this. Massive argument in the US trade union movement over this. I can't even repeat some of the language was used. Physical violence was threatened. Because one side of the labor movement, the building trades, had formed an alliance with the American Petroleum Institute in 2009, explicitly committed to exploiting North America's fossil fuel resources. That alliance still exists. So we're seeing in the trade unions a battle that we should welcome and embrace, but get on the right side of the unions who oppose not just this project, but have successfully joined struggles against coal export terminals on the West Coast, because they're blasting coal in Wyoming and Montana for export purposes. And they want to build mile-long train rail to carry the coal to export terminals to sell it to the world market. Communities and other unions are standing in the way of that expansion. This is what we mean by resist. We've seen also through Unions for Energy Democracy, a project called Unions Against Fracking. We have 30 unions now, including four large global union federations. Unions as far off as Tunisia, where fracking is being proposed, Argentina, where the unions there have sided with the indigenous community to stop fracking in the northwest part of the country. This is active resistance that unions are getting involved in. Not all unions, I hasten to add, but it is a struggle that is unfolding. Now, the recent battles, those of you who are not in the labor movement or don't follow international labor issues won't know this, but there's a major split now in the South African trade unions. And the issue is the mineral industrial complex, the exploitation of natural resources primarily for export, has divided the labor movement between those who work in those industries and those who see the dangers of allowing private companies and the corruption that's involved to ride roughshod over workers and communities. On the right is a picture of the Marikana massacre. If you've not heard of it, please look up a film called Miners Shot Down that showed how 40 miners were shot unarmed by the police in collusion with the company on the orders of the South African government. This was to put to sleep militant uprisings and strikes against the large mineral and mining companies. So this is now opening up a struggle within South African society and the trade union movement. What we're seeing in more peaceful surroundings in places like Germany is many cities now are taking their energy grids, their electricity grids, back from private corporations. They sold those grids in the 1990s. They realize now that the private energy companies, the privatization was a failure. It led to higher prices, weak penetration of renewable energy, and they want those grids back in order to deploy more renewables. So when everybody talks about the energy transition in Germany, please understand that this is not all about private markets. This is about municipalities taking control over the grid and making decisions to deploy more renewable power. And that is the case for 60 cities, 5 cities in the UK. In London, there's a campaign called Switched on London, which has set up a public utility in London, and it's supported by the second largest union in Britain, Unison, and the fifth largest, the Public and Commercial Services Union. This municipalization or re-municipalization movement is an expression of energy democracy where unions are involved, but it's also engaging communities and citizens in many parts of those countries. Programmatic work is essential. We need to be able to talk to workers, to communities, and say another energy system is possible. It needs to be democratic. It needs to be clean. It needs to be flexible. And if possible, it needs to be affordable. But the most important thing that needs to happen is that private interests and renewables for profit will not deploy renewable energy fast enough, that we need to do it as a public good. In the same way as the Roosevelt administration in the country where I live did in the 1930s. 95% of rural America did not have access to electricity. They set up the Rural Electrification Administration, and within 20 years, it was 95% electrified, mostly through hydro and coal, yes. But why not a renewable energy administration in the United States? Why not renewable energy administrations in other parts of the world in order to deploy renewable energy at a rapid speed, have a just transition for workers in the fossil fuels, plan our way out of this crisis, democratize, include people in the solutions, and not leave it to carbon prices and corporations who frankly have failed and don't have a clue how to get us to 2 degrees or anything like 2 degrees. So this document, Power to the People, is an attempt to try to explain what this system would look like. It's a work in progress. Maybe. Don't hold your breath. Don't hold your breath that Bernie Sanders will get the nomination. But he's doing much better than everybody expected. And his position on climate change and against the fossil fuel companies is the best we've seen in American politics, probably forever. He's absolutely clear on the need to control and stop big money dominating politics, oil money in particular, in the United States. In Paris, Trade Unions for Energy Democracy was very visible. You'll see Naomi Klein, Jeremy Corbyn there, and other union leaders. We're trying to put energy democracy at the center of the trade union agenda. We support a just transition for workers. We support decent work. But we don't believe those things are possible unless we confront corporate power and democratize energy, transport, and other key sectors of the economy. I want to conclude with this slide. saying, I feel very optimistic about what is happening in the world. We're winning struggles against the big oil, coal, and gas companies. We need to develop our alternatives, engage far more people, workers, and their families and communities. And a special thank you to Fagforbundet, Asbjørn Wall, my comrade, and others here who've been supporting this movement. And it's a great honor and a privilege to have this opportunity to tell you a little bit about it and to learn from all of you. And I look forward to having some informal discussion with you afterwards. Thank you very much.
Thank you.